This morning's lesson are on the pedestal in the foyer, included in your bulletin. Good to see each of you this morning. We're glad you're here. Lesson this morning was one originally I had scheduled to preach next week, as it is approaching the 25th anniversary of 9/11, as we've come to call it. But I'm going to be gone next Sunday in a meeting, and so I decided that I would present the lesson today. Those with some memory of December the 7th, 1941, and the bombing of Pearl Harbor are getting to be fewer and fewer. There are some who can vividly recall November the 22nd, 1963, where you were and what you were doing when John Kennedy was assassinated. Some can remember April the 4th, 1968, when Martin Luther King Jr. was killed in Memphis. Most can recall April the 19th, 1995, when the Alfred E. Murrah Federal Building was bombed by one of our own. The vast majority of us can remember precisely April the 16th, 2007, when 32 individuals were killed at Virginia Tech. But everyone old enough to remember exactly September the 11th, you knew exactly where you were. You can recall vividly when the news first hit. You know exactly where you were when you found out that those twin towers had been bombed. The images are indelibly etched into our memories. Let's go back for illustrative purposes and look at that day again before we apply it in the lessons at hand. At 7:59 a.m., American Airlines Flight 11, a Boeing 767, departs 14 minutes late from Logan International Airport, bound for Los Angeles. Five hijackers are aboard. At 8:14 a.m., United Airlines Flight 175, another fuel-laden Boeing 767, carrying 56 passengers and 9 crew members, departs from Boston Logan Airport, also bound for Los Angeles. Five hijackers are aboard. At 8:19 a.m., Betty Ong, a flight attendant on Flight 11, alerts American Airlines via an airphone, saying the cockpit is not answering. Somebody's stabbed in business class, and I think there's mace. We can't breathe. I don't know. I think we've been being hijacked. She then tells of the stabbing of two flight attendants. At 8:20 a.m., American Airlines Flight 77, a Boeing 757 with 58 passengers and 6 crew members, departs from Washington Dulles for Los Angeles. Five hijackers are aboard. At 8:24 a.m., a radio transmission comes from Flight 11 saying, "We have some planes. Just stay quiet and you'll be okay. We are returning to the airport." It is believed that Muhammad Atta mistakenly held a button directing his voice to the radio rather than to the plane's cabin as he intended. A few seconds later, Atta's voice says, "Nobody move. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any moves, you'll endanger yourself and the airplane. Just stay quiet." Air traffic controllers hear the transmission. At 8:30 a.m., Flight 11 makes a 100-degree turn to the south, heading toward New York City, according to the National Transportation and Safety Bureau report. At 8:42 a.m., United Flights 93, a Boeing 757, takes off with 37 passengers, 7 crew members from Newark International Airport, bound for San Francisco International Airport, following a 40-minute delay due to congested runways. 4 hijackers are aboard. Its flight path initially takes it close to the World Trade Center before moving away westwards. Also, between the time span of 8:42 and 8:46 a.m., Flight 175, which was the 8:14 flight from Boston to L.A., is hijacked. At 8:46 a.m., Flight 11, the 759 Logan International to L.A. flight, crashes at roughly 466 miles per hour into the north face of the North Tower, One World Trade Center, of the World Trade Center itself, between floors 93 and 99. The aircraft enters the tower mostly intact. It plows through the building, to its core, severing all three gypsum-encased stairwells, dragging combustibles with it. A powerful shockwave travels down the ground and up again. The combustibles and the remnants of the aircraft were ignited by the burning fuel. The building lacks a traditional full cage frame and depends almost entirely on the strength of a narrow structural core running up the center. Fire at the center of the impact zone is in a position to compromise the integrity of all internal columns. People below the severed stairwell start to evacuate. No one above the impact zone is able to do so. From 8:48 to 10:28 a.m., at least 100 people, some accounts as many as 250, primarily in the North Tower, trapped by fire and smoke in the upper floors, jumped to their deaths. One person at the street level, a firefighter, Daniel Sir, is hit by a jumper and dies. From 8:50 to 8:54, hijacking begins on Flight 77, the 820 from Washington Dulles to L.A., at 8:56, the transponder on Flight 77 is turned off, and even primary radar contact with the aircraft is lost. During radar blackout, Flight 77 turns east, unnoticed by flight controllers. When primary radar information is restored at 9:05, controllers look futilely for Flight 77 west of its previous position. Flight 77, however, travels undetected for 36 minutes, on a course heading due east toward Washington, D.C. At 8:58 a.m., Flight 175, the 814 from Logan to L.A., takes a heading toward New York City. From 9:01 to 9:02 a.m., a manager from the Federal Aeronautics Administration, New York City Center, tells the Air Traffic Control System Command Center in Hendon, Virginia, quote, "We have several situations going on here. It's escalating big, big time. We need to get the military involved with this. We're involved with something else. We have other aircraft that may have a similar situation going on here." At 9:02 a.m., Flight 175, the 814 from Logan to L.A., crashes at about 590 miles per hour into the south face of the South Tower, 2 World Trade Center, between floors 77 and 85. By this time, several media organizations, including the 3 major broadcast networks, who have interrupted their morning shows, are covering the first plane crash. Millions see the impact live. Parts of the plane leave the building from its east and north sides, falling to the ground some 6 blocks away. At 9:04 a.m., the FAA bans all takeoffs nationwide for flights going to or through New York City airspace. At 9:07 a.m., President Bush is interrupted during a school visit in Sarasota, Florida, by Andrew Card, his chief of staff, and informed that a second plane has hit the World Trade Center. At 9:28 a.m., hijackers storm the cockpit of Flight 93, the 842 from Newark to San Francisco, and take over the flight. The entry of the hijackers is overheard by flight controllers in Cleveland. At 9:37 a.m., Flight 77, the 820 from Washington to Dulles, to L.A., crashes into the western side of the Pentagon and starts a violent fire. The section of the Pentagon hit consists mainly of newly renovated, unoccupied offices. All 64 people on board are killed, as are 125 Pentagon personnel. At 9:42 a.m., Ben Slaney of the FAA issues the execution order for SCATANA, that is the security control of air traffic control and air navigation aids, grounding all air traffic over the United States, diverting any incoming international traffic to alternative destinations. At 9:45 a.m., U.S. airspace is shut down. No civilian aircraft are allowed to take off. All aircraft in flight are ordered to land at the nearest airport as soon as possible. All international flights headed for the U.S. are redirected to Canada and Mexico. Transport Canada, Canada's transportation agency, also closes down its airspace. The FAA announces that civilian flights are suspended until at least noon on September the 12th, while Transport Canada gives similar orders, but until further notice, to take in diverted U.S.-bound international flights. The groundings last until September 14th. Military and medical flights, as well as Conair flights, continue. This is the fourth time all commercial flights in the U.S. have been stopped, and the first time a suspension was unplanned. All previous suspensions were military-related from 1960 to 1962. Many newspapers, including the New York Times, mistakenly print that this is the first time flights have been suspended. This was also the first time commercial flights in Canada have been stopped. At 9:52 a.m., the National Security Agency intercepts a phone call between a known associate of Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan and someone in the Republic of Georgia, announcing that he had heard, quote, good news, and that another target was still to be hit. At 9:59 a.m., the South Tower of the World Trade Center, the second to be hit, begins to collapse. 56 minutes and 2 seconds after the impact of Flight 175, its destruction is viewed and heard by a vast television and radio audience. As the roar of the collapse goes silent, tremendous gray-white clouds of pulverized concrete and gypsum rush through the streets. Most observers think a new explosion or impact has produced smoke and debris that now obscures the South Tower. But once the room clears, the smoke becomes clear that the building is no longer there. At 10:01 a.m., the FAA Command Center advises FAA headquarters that an aircraft had seen Flight 93, the 842 from New York to San Francisco, waving its wings, quote, the hijackers' efforts to defeat the passengers' counterattack. At 10:03 a.m., United Airlines Flight 93 is crashed by the hijackers and passengers due to fighting in the cockpit 80 miles southeast of Pittsburgh in Somerset County, Pennsylvania. Later reports indicate that passengers had learned about the World Trade Center and the Pentagon crashes on cell phones, and at least three were planning on resisting the hijackers. The resistance was confirmed by Flight 93's cockpit voice recording, on which the hijackers are heard making their decision to down the plane before the passengers succeed in breaching the cockpit door. The 9/11 Commission believed that Flight 93's target was either the U.S. Capitol building or the White House itself in Washington, D.C. At 10:10 a.m., part of the west side of the Pentagon collapses. At 10:28 a.m., the north tower of the World Trade Center begins to collapse. Due to the destruction of the gypsum-encased stairwells on the impact floors, most skyscraper stairwells are encased in reinforced concrete. No one who was above the impact zone in the north tower escapes the collapse. The Marriott Hotel, located at the base of the two towers, is also destroyed. The second collapse is also viewed live on television and heard on radio. The North Tower collapses 1 hour, 41 minutes, and 45 seconds after the impact of Flight 11. At 10:50 a.m., 5 stories of part of the Pentagon collapses due to fire. At 5:20 p.m., World Trade Center, also known as the World Trade Center 7, also known as the Salomon Brothers Building, a 47-story building collapses with widespread fire. The building contained New York's Emergency Operations Center. The building contained New York's Emergency Operations Center, operated by the New York City Office of Emergency Management, originally intended to respond to disasters such as September 11th terrorist attacks, ironically enough. Due to the emergency personnel having more than enough time to evacuate the building since the collapse of the North Tower, there are no injuries or deaths as a result of this collapse. At 8:30 p.m., President Bush addresses the nation from the White House. Among his statements, he said, "Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist attacks. Terrorist attacks can shake the foundations of our biggest buildings, but they cannot touch the foundation of America. These acts shatter steel, but they cannot dent the steel of American resolve. and the search is underway for those who are behind these evil acts. We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbored them. At 11:30 p.m., President Bush enters into his journal, quote, "The Pearl Harbor of the 21st century took place today. We think it's Osama bin Laden." Some facts of interest about this. The burning towers stood for 56 minutes and 102 minutes respectively. It took 12 seconds for them to collapse, 14 years to build them. The official number of lives lost, 2,819. The number of rescue personnel lost, 403. The number of countries whose citizens lost their lives, 115. The number of families who received no remains, 1,717. The number who lost a spouse, 1,609. The number of children who lost a parent, 3,051. The days the fire continued to burn after the attacks, 99. Jobs lost in New York because of the attacks, 146,100. The estimated amount donated to 9/11 charities, $1.4 billion. The estimated number of units of blood donated immediately following the attacks, 36,000. The estimated amount raised dedicated to New York Police Department and the Fire Department of New York families, $500 million. The average benefit received by each NYPD and FDNY widow, $1 million. What are some lessons that we can learn from 9/11? First, we learned that tragedy can strike at any moment and take many different forms. The Bible tells us in Proverbs 27 and verse 1, "Boast not thyself for tomorrow, for thou knowest not what a day may bring forth." James said it in this way, "Whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow, what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanisheth away." Of the thousands who died some 25 years ago, only 19 evil men knew of the fate that awaited them that day. 246 people fully expected to get on a plane on one side of this country and get off on the other. Some 3,000 people who left their homes that day fully expected to return that night. The message for us? Be prepared. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 2, "For yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night." Peter said it this way in 2 Peter 3, "But of the day of the Lord, the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up." Time is of the essence. Matthew 24, regarding his second coming, Jesus said, "Watch therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the goodman of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore be ye also ready, for in such hours you think not, the Son of Man cometh." We need to be prepared because we never know what a day may bring forth. Tragedy can come at any moment, and it can take many different forms. But second, we learn that evil will always exist in this world. Proverbs 2, verse 10, beginning, "When wisdom entereth into thine heart, and knowledge is pleasant to thy soul, discretion shall preserve thee, understanding shall keep thee, to deliver thee from the way of the evil men, from the man that speaketh forward things, who leave the paths of uprightness to walk in the ways of darkness, who rejoice to do evil and delight in the frowardness of the wicked, whose ways are crooked, and they froward in their paths." Solomon said it this way simply, "An ungodly man diggeth up evil." Evil will always be in this world. 2 Timothy 3, Paul said, "But evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived." Evil, the existence of evil, is the atheist's strongest argument for saying there is no God. But how does an atheist constitute what is evil? You see, in the very word itself, there is a moral terminology. To say that there is evil is to say that there is a basis for that. In order for moral evil to exist, there has to be an absolute moral standard. Some years ago, Brother Thomas B. Warren debated a man on the Warren Mattson on the existence of God. Prior to that debate, they had agreed to give each other 10 questions to be asked. Brother Warren asked Dr. Mattson this question: did the Nazi Germany commit evil when they destroyed millions of Jews? Mr. Mattson answered yes. Brother Warren then asked the question: what law did the Nazis violate? And he gave them a multiple choice. He said American law, Germany's law, or the moral law. Mr. Mattson wouldn't answer the question. To say he rejected and violated American law, Nazis weren't under American law. To say they violated the law of Germany and made their actions evil, they were the German law. He wouldn't answer the moral law because in saying so, he would have given up his proposition that I know that God does not exist. But according to atheism, there is no absolute wrong. Atheism's system is based on subjectivism, self-centered standards such as the good of society. But how can the good of society be determined if all such standards are left up to the individual or the groups of individuals? Atheism, then, in trying to regulate evil in any fashion, relinquishes its argument, since any regulation of wrong automatically acknowledges the existence of wrong and implies an absolute and moral standard to determine wrong. To acknowledge an absolute standard is to acknowledge the source of that, which ultimately is God. By what or by whose standard will atheism judge evil? By Bin Laden's standard? By Al-Qaeda's standard? By Islam's standard? Until atheism solves this problem, it has no right to even speak about evil. And each time it does, it relinquishes its own argument against God's existence. Evil will always be in the world. But another lesson is there is still a world of good in this bad world. Think about all the good that was done on that day, from the donation of blood, the donation of money, to the donation of time. Good men and women revealed their caring side in the midst of crisis. Many demonstrated their compassion and common bond of humanity during that time. Hundreds risked and even gave their lives and well-being to save the others. Stories of that abounded, of course. Genesis 6 and verse 7 beginning, the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, the creeping thing, the fowls of the air, and it repented me that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. It's always been the case that there is a remnant of good, even in a very evil world. You recall Elijah, the great prophet, in 1 Kings chapter 19. He was fleeing from Jezebel and Ahab, Jezebel primarily. The Bible says, he, Elijah, came thither into a cave and lodged there. Behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said unto him, what doest thou here, Elijah? And he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with a sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. You recall it just a few verses later. The Lord said to him, yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees of which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which hath not kissed him. Many times we feel like Elijah, maybe, that we are the only ones trying to do good in this evil, wicked world. But as the Lord told Elijah, there's always a remnant that will do good. There is still a world of good in this bad world. But finally we learn not to fail to remember in this world of forgetting. We're forgetful people, of course. Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 1, Solomon said, remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. The evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. We have to be reminded not to forget. We have to be reminded to remember. Hebrews 13 and verse 16, but to do good and communicate, forget not. For with such sacrifices, God is well pleased. After 9/11, we decried, we will never forget. 25 years later, a Muslim mayor in New York. How quickly we've forgotten. We erect memorials to keep us from forgetting significant days, significant events, and significant people. God has had man in the past erect monuments at various times. Exodus 13, beginning verse 7, unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days. There shall no leavened bread be seen with thee, neither shall there be leaven seen with thee in all thy quarters. Thou shalt show thy son in that day, saying, this is done, notice, because of that which the Lord did unto me when I came forth out of Egypt. And it shall be for a sign unto thee upon thine hand, for a memorial between thine eyes, that the Lord's law may be in thy mouth. For with a strong hand hath the Lord brought them out of Egypt. Again in Joshua 4 and verse 5, Joshua said unto them, pass over before the ark of the Lord, your God, in the midst of the Jordan. And to the priests take you up every man of you a stone upon his shoulder, according unto the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, that this may be a sign among you, that when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what mean you by these stones? Then you shall answer them that the waters of Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it passed over Jordan, the waters of Jordan were cut off. And these stones shall be for a memorial unto the children of Israel forever. He has given us a most significant memorial of the most significant event in history as well. Paul spoke of it in these terms. And when he given thanks, he broke it and said, take, eat. This is my body which is broken for you. This do in remembrance of me. Notice in memory. After the same manner also he took the cup when he had supped, saying, this cup is the New Testament of my blood. This do ye as oft as you drink it in remembrance of me. Very tragic event, 9/11 in our country. It will live on vividly in the minds of those of us who were alive at that time and who saw, as the news reports gave it, firsthand the effects of evil in our society. What can we learn from such an event? We learn that tragedy can strike at any moment, take many different forms. We learn we need to be prepared. We learn that evil will always exist in this world, that because the influence of Satan and his forces, that because evil entered into a pristine world and continues to grow. We learn there is still a world of good in this bad world. Don't judge a book by its cover. Don't judge the world by sometimes seemingly the majority of people in the world, because there is still good. There are yet 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. And we should learn not to fail to remember in the world of forgetting. We will never forget. Those words were in a banner over New York City. Those words reflected on our mindset, and yet how quickly people soon forgot. We need reminders, like the anniversary of those events. So we don't forget Pearl Harbor, assassination of political figures in our land, tragedies such as the Alfred Murrah Federal Building, tragedies such as the Virginia Tech shooting, tragedies, though man-made, by 9/11. This world is not our home, and we could be taken from this world at any moment through tragedy, which comes in many different ways and many different sources. We have to be prepared, because evil will always exist in this world. But as bad as the evil is, there will always be good people in this bad world. We should seek to be one of those 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. And we learn that we must remember, because all too often we forget. Remember the things that are really important. Remember the Lord and what He's done for us, for His sacrifice to purchase the church and to purchase the salvation and redemption of every one of us. The purpose of the Lord's Supper is so that we will remember, so that we will not forget. This morning, as we think about this tragedy and reflect upon that 25 years ago, it's a repeated thing, as we've seen. If the world exists, evil will continue to have its way in many arenas. But we can still be good people in the midst of a bad world. But we're only good, as Jesus said, why callest thou me good? There's none good but one, which is God, to the rich young ruler. If we're going to be good, we'll have to be good in God's standards and in His eyes. In order to be good, we have to be right with Him, righteous before Him, faithful to His cause. One who's never obeyed the gospel of Christ must believe Jesus to be the Son of God, John 8:24. He must repent of his sins, Luke 13:3. Confess the name of Christ before men, Romans 10:9-10. And be baptized for the remission of sins, Acts 2:38. When he does that, he's added to the church, Acts 2:47. His sins are washed away, Acts 22:16, in the blood of Christ, Revelation 1:5. Less than that will not attain an individual the remission of his sins or a place in the kingdom. You can't join the church to save your life, but you'll have to be added to it to save your soul. In order to continue in that faithfulness, we have to walk in the light of God's Word, 1 John 1:7. In essence, we have to strive to be good in a world that's filled with bad. So this morning, as we examine our lives in light of that which has been and which will likely be, are you good in God's sight? Are you faithful to Him? Do you know that if any moment tragedy did strike and your life were taken, you would have that eternal home in heaven? Hereby we know Him if we keep His commandments. This morning, if you need to obey the gospel, be restored to faithful service, if we can assist you in that in any way, won't you come while we stand and while we sing?